The opinions expressed on the following program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, and welcome to Audio Journal's look at history from all points of the globe, a program that reports on what has happened so we might consequently find out what could happen. I'm Doug Johnson, and for the next hour, we'll explore the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center, not your usual house museum. Then George Robert Twelves Hughes, a last survivor of the Boston Tea Party. Then Maxfield Parrish, a mechanic who painted fantastically. Also John Wingate Weeks, the improbable savior of the White Mountain forests. And then Samuel Williams watches an eclipse from behind British lines in 1780. And finally, overlooked no more, Beatrix Potter, author of The Tale of Peter Rabbit. This first article is titled The Harriet Beecher Stowe Center, Not Your Usual House Museum. It was published in the newsletter of the New England Historical Society. Harriet Beecher Stowe forced people to think about the evil and immorality of slavery with the publication of her novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, or Life Among the Lowly. Today, the Stowe Center in Hartford aims to keep people thinking. Until the book shot up to the top of the bestseller list, abolitionists were considered radicals on the fringe of political beliefs. Stowe, born in Litchfield, Connecticut, and her husband, Calvin Ellis Stowe, from Natick, Massachusetts, were ardent abolitionists. They supported the Underground Railroad. When Congress in 1850 passed the Fugitive Slave Act, states had to help return escaped slaves to Southern slave owners. Officials who didn't arrest suspected runaways were subject to fines, as were citizens helping the escapees. Special commissioners were empowered to police the law, and due process was eliminated for slaves captured in the North. The act aimed to stop the flow of escaped slaves into Canada, a safe haven for slaves following the American Revolution. The British helped relocate slaves who fought for them in Canada rather than let them face re-enslavement after the war. The law only further stoked the anger of abolitionists, and it prompted Stowe to pick up her pen. She began writing Uncle Tom's Cabin at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine, where her husband taught. It started as a serial in a magazine, but soon John P. Jewett of Boston approached Stowe about publishing it as a book. Initially doubtful about its potential, Stowe nevertheless agreed to publication. Following its release on March 20, 1852, sales rocketed both in the U.S. and Britain. Uncle Tom's Cabin brought the fringe issue of abolition into the mainstream. More than 300,000 copies of the book sold in its first year in the U.S., with even greater sales in Britain. After several years, it went out of print, but it found a new audience during the Civil War when the publisher reprinted it. The story most often associated with the book today is that Abraham Lincoln, when introduced to Stowe in Washington, D.C. in 1862, said, "So this is the little lady who started this great war." He probably didn't say that, but the book unquestionably inflamed sentiment against slavery. Stowe spent the last 23 years of her life in the Nook Farm neighborhood of Hartford. She didn't start out there, though. When her husband, the Reverend Calvin Stowe, resigned from teaching at Andover Theological Seminary, supervised the construction of a mansion she called Oak Home. Oak Home, however, got too expensive to maintain. In 1873, the Stowes moved to the 5,000-square-foot Victorian cottage at Nook Farm. There she wrote more books, supported the Wadsworth Athenaeum, and worked to establish the Hartford Art School. She was at the end of her career, and a young upstart with the pen name of Mark Twain was building a fabulous house next door. The Clemens and Stowe families became friends as well as neighbors. Stowe died in 1896 in her upstairs bedroom, surrounded by family. The family sold the house, but her grandniece, Catherine Seymour Day, bought it back in 1924. Day also bought the Twain House and restored both. She bequeathed both to a foundation aimed at preserving Stowe's legacy of work towards social justice. Today, the Mark Twain House ranks as number one tourist attraction in Hartford. The Harriet Beecher Stowe Center, unlike its neighbor, won't wow visitors. Rather, it aims to provoke thought and discussion of social justice in the context of Harriet Beecher Stowe's life and work. The Stowe Center doesn't focus on the contents of the house or historical facts. Rather, the tour guides seek to provoke discussions about social justice. Some people find that approach unnecessarily political and off-putting, while others love it. Harriet and her sister, Catherine Beecher, published a book in 1869 called The American Woman's Home. It included their pioneering and influential ideas about kitchen design. The kitchen at the Stowe Center reflects those ideas. A coal stove at one end, a kitchen table in the center, and shelves along the wall. The house includes some original Victorian and late 18th century furniture owned by Harriet Beecher Stowe. It includes a mahogany drop-leaf table on which she wrote the beginnings of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Don't expect the Stowe Center guides to make a big deal about the furniture, though. Who knew Harriet Beecher Stowe also painted in her spare time? Along the walls of the house are her paintings, many of which have religious subjects. You would never mistake Harriet Beecher Stowe for a neatnik, and the Stowe Center has kept her original desk as messy as she died. The Stowe Center and the Twain House belong to the historic Nook Farm neighborhood in the Asylum Hills section on the western side of Hartford. The original developers divided up an old farm and sold parcels to friends and family. It evolved into a tight-knit community of reformers, authors, and intellectuals. Some of the houses have been demolished, but some big old architecturally stylish houses survive. They include the Catherine Day House, a museum open to the public. Many people go to see the Mark Twain House and then visit the Stowe Center as an add-on. There is a small discount for visiting both houses. Tours are required for the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center and are recommended in advance via their website. They run about 45 minutes and are intended to be participatory. You won't have time to go back through the house on your own. Ample parking is available near the house, though the house itself isn't good for people with mobility issues. There is a gift shop, but be forewarned. It has been described as a social justice library. The Stowe Center opens to the public year-round, Wednesday through Saturdays. Hartford residents can get in free. We recently celebrated the 250th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. So I thought I would read this article titled, George Robert Twelves Hughes, a Last Survivor of the Boston Tea Party. He was a little man with a big name. This article was written by Rebecca Rector and appeared in the New England Historical Society newsletter. For many years after the Boston Tea Party, the identities of the men who participated remained a closely guarded secret. But time passed, and the people who threw the tea into Boston Harbor came out of obscurity. Here is the story of one of them, George Robert Twelves Hughes. Tensions had been growing since 1765 as Britain imposed more taxes on the colonists. Although most taxes had been lifted by 1773, the tea tax remained and Parliament bailed out the East India Company. In September, ships of East India Company tea sailed from London, bound for four American cities. In Boston, many of the merchants who had shops near Griffin's Wharf began gathering in the Old South Meeting House to debate the tea tax. Many belonged to the Sons of Liberty, a radical political organization. On December 16th, the crowd rushed to the wharf. Some began throwing tea into the harbor in what later became known as the Boston Tea Party. One of the men who actively participated was George Robert Twelves Hughes, a poor shoemaker who had a shop along the wharf. George was born in Boston in 1742 to George Hughes and Abigail Seaver. He was baptized in the Old South Church and named George after his father, Robert after an uncle, and Twelves after his maternal grandmother, Abigail Twelves of Braintree. George's father, a tanner, died in 1749. According to Encyclopedia.com, George was sent to family members in Wrentham. He then apprenticed to a shoemaker in Boston. He later opened his own shoe shop on Griffin's Wharf. In 1768, he married Sally Sumner, and they had 15 children. They named their 11th child Eleven Hughes, and their 15th George Robert Twelves 15 Hughes, often listed as George RTF. At one point, George tried to enlist in the British Army to serve against the French. The Army rejected him because of his height, 5 feet 1 inches. George's revolutionary participation began in 1770 during the Boston Massacre. He joined the mob of apprentices harassing British soldiers and went home with a sore shoulder from a British rifle butt. The massacre further enraged the colonists. By early December of 1773, three ships moored in Boston Harbor, laden with tea, the Dartmouth, the Eleanor, and the Beaver. On the night of December 16th, thousands attended a meeting at the Old South Meeting House. Afterward, many headed to the wharf, disguised with blackened faces and tomahawks. Each ship had a boarding crew, and George Hughes was appointed as boatswain, a de facto officer, on the Dartmouth. That night, they broke 342 chests of tea and threw them into the water. The armed British ships that surrounded them made no attempt to interfere. However, Britain then passed the Intolerable Acts. The legislature closed the harbor, moved judicial authority to Britain, and ended the Massachusetts Constitution and free elections of town officials. The other colonies sent aid to Boston and began plotting further resistance. That led to the First Continental Congress in March of 1774, and finally to, quote, the shot heard round the world in 1775, which began the Revolutionary War. As the war began, George sent his growing family to Wrentham, his father's hometown. During the war, he served in the militia and as a privateer. According to his 1832 pension application, George served as a seaman, commanded by Captain Samuel Smedley on the ship Defense for 7 months and 15 days. He also served as a private for 9 months in Attleboro, and he served as a privateer in Providence, where he assisted in the capture of several British ships. During the 1830s, the Revolution revived in people's memory. Cities and towns remembered soldiers and events from the war, and commemorated battles from 50 years ago. In 1833, James Hawkes published a biography of George Hughes entitled A Retrospective of the Boston Tea Party. In 1835, Benjamin B. Thatcher also published a memoir, Traits of the Boston Tea Party, being a memoir of George Robert Twelves Hughes. It included an interview with George, who gave first-hand accounts of the Tea Party. George Hughes was fast becoming recognized as one of the last survivors of the Boston Tea Party. He went to Boston in 1835, and Fourth of July celebrants cheered him as a guest of honor. Joseph Cole even painted a portrait of Hughes, which hangs in Boston's old State House. Because George lived to a ripe old age, he was one of the few Tea Party participants whose memoirs were later recorded and published. He was not a famous John Hancock or a Paul Revere, but an ordinary man, a poor shoemaker, who caught people's attention. In his later years, he was still poor, living a quiet life with various relatives in and near Otsego County, New York. He still participated in festivities every 4th of July. He was probably the man of 100 years listed in the household of William Morrison, his son-in-law, in nearby German Flats in the 1840 census. George was injured in an accident on July 4, 1840, and died on November 5. Several newspapers reported that he died in German Flats near Richfield Springs. The Hartford Courant stated that his remains were sent to Richfield, where he had lived for many years. Most newspapers reported his age as 106 or even 109, which is unlikely. He was probably 98. His leadership during the Tea Party was praised, declaring that, quote, in the heat of the conflict, the small man with the large name had been elevated from a poor shoemaker to Captain Hughes. Here's an article titled Maxfield Parrish, a mechanic who painted fantastically. I know the name Maxfield Parrish, but I really don't know much about his work. This is also from the New England Historical Society. The landscape of Vermont and New Hampshire inspired Maxwell Parrish in 1922 to create the lush, romantic painting Daybreak. Daybreak became the most popular art print of the 20th century. One in four U.S. households owned a print of the neoclassical landscape with two beautiful nymphs in the foreground. Parrish's spectacularly imaginative art made him famous and allowed him to live comfortably with his family in the Cornish art colony. There, he entertained President Woodrow Wilson, actress Ethel Barrymore, and journalist Walter Lippmann. Norman Rockwell idolized him from across the Connecticut River in Vermont. Calendars he illustrated as advertisements sold by the millions, and a shade of cobalt blue was even named after him. Maxfield Parrish didn't understand his own popularity, or at least claimed not to. Quote, I am hopelessly commonplace. I don't know what people see in me, he once said. His methodical, almost mechanical way of painting produced brilliant effects of color and light. He adapted the new process printing technique to methods used by the old masters. He started with a monochrome underpainting and then layered on transparent glazes, and between each layer he applied varnish. This method is very simple, very ancient, very laborious, and by no means original with me, he said. He called himself a mechanic who paints. Maxfield Parrish was born July 25, 1870, in Philadelphia, to artists Stephen Parrish and Elizabeth Bancroft Parrish. His parents named him Frederick, but he later adopted his maternal grandmother's maiden name. From childhood, he wanted to be an artist, and his parents encouraged him. When he turned 10, his father took him on a tour of European art museums. They sketched together in Europe and in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Philadelphia. After graduating from the Pennsylvania College of Arts, he and his father shared a studio in the Annisquam village of Gloucester, Massachusetts. He studied art for another year at the Drexel Institute of Art, Science, and Industry, then embarked on a wildly successful career. During the golden age of American illustration, artists produced a prodigious amount of fresh, exciting pictures for books and magazines. There was little difference between commercial and fine art during the period, roughly lasting from 1880 to 1920. It was triggered by innovations in mass color printing and led by such Brandywine artists as Howard Pyle and N.C. Wyeth. Successful illustrators achieved celebrity in their day, their names household words. Maxfield Parrish belonged to that group. He illustrated greeting cards, advertisements, and children's books, including Arabian Nights and Poems of Childhood. His work arrived in the mailboxes of millions of homes, appearing on the cover of Harper's Bazaar, Collier's, and Scribner's magazine. His paintings for full-color calendars for Edison Mazda lamps sold in the hundreds of thousands, sometimes the millions. People often framed them at the end of the year. By 1910, he was so successful he was earning more than $100,000 a year, in a time when a home could be bought for $2,000. Maxfield Parrish was only 28 in 1898 when he and his new wife, Lydia Austin, could afford to build a house in Plainfield, New Hampshire. Plainfield belonged to the Cornish art colony, and his father had already moved there. He urged the young couple to join him. Maxfield Parrish built a house across the river from his father and called it The Oaks. He lived there until his death on March 30, 1966. The Cornish art colony flourished from 1895 to about 1925. Led by August St. Gaudens, it included artists, sculptors, writers, politicians, and entertainers. They lived in the towns of Plainfield and Cornish in New Hampshire and across the Connecticut River in Windsor, Vermont. Residents included President Woodrow Wilson, artist Frederick Remington, dancer Isadora Duncan, actress Marie Dressler, sculptor Daniel Chester French, and literary editor Maxwell Perkins. In 1922, Maxfield Parrish finished what he called, quote, the great painting Daybreak. He used three models, Kitty Owen, William Jennings Bryan's granddaughter, his daughter Jean, and Susan Lewin, his young nanny. The painting achieved staggering success. Still in print, Daybreak outsold Andy Warhol's Campbell's Soup Cans and Da Vinci's Last Supper. Parrish eventually moved out of the Oaks and into the studio with Susan Lewin. His wife began to take long trips with their four children. The arrangement scandalized Plainfield, but Parrish and Lewin claimed to have only a platonic friendship. Meanwhile, the public demanded more images of lissome nymphs and androgynous youths in sumptuous landscapes and fantastical scenes, and so Maxfield Parrish obligingly churned them out. In 1931, Maxfield Parrish told the Associated Press, quote, I'm done with girls on rocks. He abandoned illustration for landscape painting, which was more satisfying but less lucrative. He hadn't finished with Susan Lewin, though. Their arrangement continued for 55 years until Lydia Parrish died in 1960. Maxfield Parrish was 90. Susan Lewin was 71, and they could finally marry. He declined, and she left him to marry someone else. Paris continued to paint landscapes and murals until his death. His clients included the Vanderbilts, Whitneys, Astors, DuPonts, and Hearsts. In 2006, actor Mel Gibson's wife, Robin, bought Daybreak at Christie's for $7.6 million. The, quote, mechanic who paints had an abiding love for machinery. He built a shop beneath his studio and filled it with machines. With them, he created model scenes, props, and lighting effects for his paintings. One of his sons, Stephen, became an airline mechanic. Another son, Maxfield Parrish Jr., helped create the self-developing camera at Edwin Land's Polaroid Corporation. Daughter Jean became an artist. Daybreak continues to influence popular culture. Variations were used on a Moody Blues album cover, in a Michael Jackson music video, a Bloom County cartoon collection, and the movie poster for The Princess Bride. A Maxfield Parrish enthusiast bought the Oaks. He then rebuilt it after it burned. It was put up for sale in its entirety for $1.15 million in 2017. You can visit the center of the Cornish Art Colony, St. Gaudens National Historic Site, a National Park Service site. I have wonderful memories of time spent in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Here's an article, also from the New England Historical Society, titled John Wingate Weeks, the Improbable Savior of the White Mountain Forests. If you had to guess who saved the White Mountain Forest from destruction, you probably wouldn't come up with a politically ambitious investment banker. But it was John Wingate Weeks who authored one of the most important pieces of environmental legislation in the 20th century, the Weeks Act. He had quite a challenge on his hands. Timber barons and powerful politicians opposed the government purchase of federal land to save it. But then devastating forest fires broke out on clear-cut land in both the West and the East. Suddenly, people saw the sense in saving the environment. On the face of it, John Wingate Weeks was an improbable savior of the White Mountain Forest. He had made a fortune as the founder of Hornblower and Weeks, a Boston investment and brokerage firm. At 40, he had enough money to turn his attention to Republican politics, starting out as a Newton, Massachusetts alderman in 1899. He was a two-term congressman angling for a seat on the powerful House Banking Committee. House Speaker Joe Cannon, however, appointed him to the House Agricultural Committee. The clever Cannon knew Weeks had concerns about the devastation of the White Mountain Forests. Weeks was born on April 11, 1860, in Lancaster, New Hampshire, the gateway to the Great North Woods region. He had grown up watching timber barons clear-cut enormous swaths of trees. He also owned a summer estate on Mount Prospect, with sweeping views of the White Mountains. Weeks agreed to sponsor legislation to restore the forests. He wasn't the only one upset about the destruction of the White Mountain Forests. Deforestation created an ugly landscape. In 1889, the Forest Service warned the timber barons were destroying the business of 1,100 inns and hotels in the mountains. The clear-cutting caused flooding, erosion, and forest fires. Devastating fires then swept through the Zeeland Valley in 1886 and 1897, laying waste to a lumber company town. Crawford Notch suffered terrible erosion. In 1864, George Perkins Marsh laid the intellectual underpinnings for the preservation movement in his book Man and Nature, or Physical Geography as Modified by Human Action. Then in 1900, an Episcopal minister named John Johnson published a pamphlet called The Boa Constrictor of the White Mountains, or The Worst Trust in the World. Johnson had ministered to poor families in northern New Hampshire for years, and he knew the cause of their suffering. The New Hampshire Land Company, a monopoly formed by timber barons. Johnson wrote the trust was starving out small-scale loggers by refusing to sell them wooded land. Eventually, the small loggers had to sell their own land to the trust at reduced prices. The trust, he wrote, was bent on reducing entire sections of the forest to a, quote, blackened, hideous, howling wilderness. Johnson's pamphlet stoked a public outcry. It also inspired the formation in 1901 of the Society for the Preservation of New Hampshire Forests. The group began petitioning the federal government to buy land in the White Mountains and create a national park. Many, including Joe Cannon, strongly opposed the idea of the federal government buying private land. Led by Western politicians, Congress rejected more than 40 bills that would preserve the eastern forests. Cannon declared, quote, not 1 cent for scenery. Then came the devastating Western fires of 1910, a result of deforestation. The fires burned 3 million acres and killed 85 people. The fires changed some minds, including Cannon's. When Cannon appointed John Wingate Weeks to the Agriculture Committee, he told him, quote, if you can frame a forestry bill which you, as a businessman, are willing to support, I will do what I can to get an opportunity to get its consideration in the House. Weeks came up with a bill that businessmen could love. It justified federal purchases of land at the headwaters of navigable rivers for the purpose of promoting commerce. The language of the 1911 Weeks Act allowed it to pass constitutional review under the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. In reality, the Weeks Act was the single most important legislation for the return of forests to the eastern United States. On March 1, 1911, President William Howard Taft signed the bill. The Weeks Act saved major national forests, including Allegheny National Forest, White Mountain National Forest, Green Mountain National Forest, Pisgah National Forest, George Washington National Forest, and the Ottawa National Forest. John Wingate Weeks then went on to serve as a U.S. Senator and Secretary of War. His most enduring legacy, though, was the Weeks Act. He died on July 12, 1926. His children then donated his estate, atop Mount Prospect in Lancaster, to the state of New Hampshire. It is now a 420-acre park that offers stunning views of the White Mountain National Forest. This next article is titled, Samuel Williams Watches an Eclipse from Behind British Lines in 1870. It also was published in the newsletter of the New England Historical Society. The American Revolution in 1870 didn't stop Harvard professor Samuel Williams from venturing behind British lines in Maine to observe a total eclipse of the sun. The British fort in Maine had recently been attacked unsuccessfully by a huge American fleet, but the British commander gave Samuel Williams safe passage to watch the eclipse. He knew the data he gathered would benefit both sides, whoever won the war. So, on October 21, 1780, the first American eclipse expedition watched the moon's shadow partially cross the sun from an island in Penobscot Bay. Then, to their dismay, the moon drew back before it totally eclipsed the sun. Modern historians blame Samuel Williams for an embarrassing failure, for they say he miscalculated the total eclipse by a few miles. But it didn't fail. Samuel Williams made observations important to geographers and mariners, and if anyone should be viewed as the scientific goat, it's the British commander, who limited the time and the place of their observations. He was born in April 23, 1743, in Waltham, Massachusetts, to the Reverend Warham Williams and his wife, Abigail Leonard. He graduated from Harvard in 1761, but missed his commencement exercises. Instead, he traveled on a scientific expedition to observe the transit of Venus in Newfoundland with John Winthrop, his teacher. Winthrop was Hollis Professor of Mathematics and Natural Philosophy. Winthrop offered scientific explanations for natural phenomena. Earthquakes, for example, resulted from seismic activity rather than God's wrath, he wrote. Winthrop was great-grandson of the John Winthrop who founded the Massachusetts Bay Colony. He was also grandson of Connecticut Governor John Winthrop, who donated the first telescope to Harvard in 1672. After Samuel Williams graduated from Harvard, he taught for a few years, then got a job as a minister in Concord. From 1764 to 79, he served as a minister in Bradford, Massachusetts. Then in 1780, Williams, along with John Adams and James Bowden, founded the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Sam Adams and John Hancock also got involved. That same year, Williams succeeded John Winthrop as the designated spokesman for science in the Massachusetts colony. Williams knew that on October 21, 1780, Europeans in America would have the opportunity to see a total solar eclipse, something they have never done successfully. A total eclipse was a big thing. It would allow observers to measure longitude in America by computing the distance from Greenwich. The uncertainty of longitude in almost all locations in America, quote, bedeviled the best geographers and mariners into the early 19th century, wrote Robert Rothschild in Two Brides for Apollo, The Life of Samuel Williams. Williams had a problem, though. The best place to watch the eclipse, according to his calculations, was near Penobscot Bay, but the British controlled the area. Penobscot Bay served as a primary entry point for European shipping well into the 19th century. The British viewed it as vital to the war. Close to home port, it gave them access to timber for masts and a strategic base to defend against privateers while protecting loyalists. So the British constructed Fort George at the mouth of the Penobscot River in Castine in 1779. Patriots in Massachusetts learned of the British fort on their territory. Maine then belonged to Massachusetts. So, in 1779, they launched an expedition to dislodge them. The Penobscot expedition came to grief as the worst naval disaster in U.S. history. Shortly after the expedition's failure, Massachusetts Speaker of the House, John Hancock, wrote a letter to the commander at Fort George asking for Samuel Williams' safe passage and permission to set up an observation site. Colonel Campbell, the commanding officer, gave them 5 days and insisted they stay off the mainland. Those were hardly ideal conditions. Nonetheless, Williams and his small troop, 3 assistants and 6 students, packed their telescopes and set out from Maine in an old galley ship, the Lincoln. They selected a site on the island of Aldborough, across from Castine. There they set up their equipment with the help of Captain Henry Mowat. Mowat had burned Portland, then Falmouth, and repulsed American ships during the Penobscot expedition. The group spent several days preparing for the observation. On Friday, they were delighted to see there was not a cloud in the sky. They had breakfast early. Quote, all was hurry and agitation. The eagerness of expectation gave us a brisk flow to the spirits and gave life and vivacity for the business of the day, wrote one student. Just before 11 a.m., they adjusted their 5 telescopes and began to count the minutes and seconds for what they expected to be a total eclipse. The sky got murky and dark. The air grew chilly and damp. The eclipse, quote, seemed to spread a general amazement among all sorts of animals, wrote Williams. Nor could we ourselves observe such unusual phenomenon without some disagreeable feelings. During the 1-hour-and-19-minute eclipse, the scientists noted 2/3 as much dew was deposited as on the entire 2 nights before and after. Just seconds after 12:30 p.m. on October 27, 1780, Williams and his party realized they hadn't seen totality. They later realized the map of Islesboro was slightly off. If they looked east across Penobscot Bay, they would have seen darkness for 5 seconds on the mainland, about 5 miles away. A total eclipse would have allowed more precise measurements. As such, they needed several more days to adjust their clocks and make more calculations. But Colonel Campbell had rushed them away. Only a few more days would have made the observations more meaningful, but Williams and his crew recorded sufficient data to accurately calculate their exact longitude and latitude. Without realizing it, Williams described Bailey's beads, drops of sunlight that shine through the rugged lunar landscape as it passes the sun. A British astronomer, Francis Bailey, later took credit for the observation. But Samuel Williams's eclipse chasing was the first instance of state-supported scientific research in America. The expedition was supported by Harvard, the Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Quote, it is remarkable to learn that even in the midst of the armed struggle, scientific advancement was considered by both sides important enough to take priority over the more ephemeral concerns of politics and military supremacy, wrote Lars D.H. Hedbor in the Journal of the American Revolution. Quote, even as the course of history was being decided on the battlefields, this history of ideas and knowledge continued to unfold, only occasionally being hindered by mundane events. In 1787, Samuel Williams surveyed the boundary between Massachusetts and New York State. He resigned his post at Harvard in 1788 after he was accused of forgery and went to work at a church in Rutland, Vermont. There he helped found the University of Vermont, and he founded and edited the Rutland Herald. He died in Rutland, Vermont on January 2, 1817. And finally, here's an article from the New York Times. This article is titled, Beatrix Potter, author of The Tale of Peter Rabbit. She created one of the world's best-known characters for children and fought to have the book published, but she never sought celebrity status. This article was written by Jess Bidgood. With The Tale of Peter Rabbit, Beatrix Potter created what would become one of the world's best-known children's book characters. The book, about a cheeky rabbit who steals vegetables from the garden of one Mr. McGregor and loses his coat and shoes in a narrow escape, became a literary juggernaut that has sold more than 45 million copies. It also spawned a merchandising empire and has left an indelible imprint on children's book publishing. But Potter's manuscript was initially dismissed by publishers. The year was 1900, and Potter, then in her mid-30s, had submitted her book complete with her own intricate illustrations, to at least 6 publishers, according to her biographer, Linda Lear. As the rejections flowed in, she unloaded her frustrations in a letter to a family friend, including a sketch depicting herself, little book in hand, arguing with a man in a long coat. Quote, "I wonder if that book will ever be printed," she fumed. She finally decided to print it herself. The next September, she took her savings to a private printer in London and ordered 250 copies of the book, which she distributed herself. The demand was so great that she soon needed to print 200 more. One early admirer, she wrote in a letter, was Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the Sherlock Holmes mysteries. Finally, in 1902, Frederick Warren and Company, a London publishing house that was among those that had initially rejected the manuscript, released Peter Rabbit to a wider audience. As the books flew off shelves, or hopped off, as the case may be, Potter sensed a merchandising opportunity. She designed a Peter Rabbit doll, injecting the legs with lead to help it stand up, and registered it as a patent number 4233888. Soon there were china figurines, wallpaper, and more dolls, products she jokingly called, quote, sideshows, even as she involved herself in their design, copyright, and quality control. Quote, "If it were done at all, it ought to be done by me," she wrote to her editor, Norman Warren, after a reader approached her with another wallpaper design in 1904. The idea of rooms covered with badly drawn rabbits, Potter added, is appalling. Potter died of heart ailments and complications of bronchitis on December 22, 1943, during World War II. She was 77. Though the death was not initially reported by the New York Times for reasons lost to history, the newspaper referred to it in subsequent weeks and months, noting that she left behind an estate worth $845,000, about $15 million in today's dollars, and that Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, had bought all 15 copies of The Tale of Peter Rabbit from a London bookstore to keep at Buckingham Palace. In her lifetime, Potter went on to write 22 more books, whimsical but razor-sharp stories about soon-to-become enduring characters like Jeremiah Puddleduck and Benjamin Bunny. Her characters, dressed in waistcoats and bonnets, were rendered with meticulous attention to anatomical detail, an outgrowth of Potter's long interest in natural science. Her deep involvement with the business side of book writing, dealing with licensing, for example, was unusual at a time when unmarried women's economic and social standing were limited. Quote, "It's just historically remarkable that we have this female author, a children's author in particular, who had such control over her work," Chloe Flower, an assistant professor of English literature at Bryn Mawr College, said in an interview. It also gave Potter a pathway out of the overbearing home life that confined most women in her day. Helen Beatrix Potter was born on July 28, 1866, in London to Rupert and Helen Leach Potter. Her father was a barrister, her mother a daughter of a successful merchant. Potter's paternal grandfather had been a wealthy calico trader and a member of Parliament. Beatrix's upbringing was a whirlwind of country houses and idyllic vacations, but it was stifling, too, hemmed in by a narrow set of expectations for women, a tense relationship with her mother, and a paucity of friends. Nature gave her an escape and a sense of purpose. She and her younger brother, Bertram, collected insects and frogs, caught and tamed mice, and trapped rabbits to observe them. She drew them and just about everything else endlessly, binding her sketchbooks with string at first, according to her biographer, Lear, who wrote Beatrix Potter, A Life in Nature. Bertram was sent to school, but Beatrix was not. She was taught by governesses, took art lessons, and made regular trips to the Natural History Museum in London to find specimens to draw. In the mid-1890s, she sold drawings of frogs and other work to a fine arts publisher. Quote, "One must make out some way," she wrote in her journal in 1895. "It is something to have a little money to spend on books and to look forward to being independent, though forlorn." She took a particular interest in mycology, the study of fungi, which she would examine under a microscope, and despite her amateur status, sought out the experts at the Royal Botanical Gardens at Kew in London. With encouragement from her uncle, a prominent chemist, Potter had a paper of hers submitted to the Linnaean Society, an organization devoted to natural history, but it went unnoticed, a slight that the Society apologized for after her death. By the turn of the century, Potter found herself over 30 and in need of something else to do. 7 years earlier, she had written what she called, quote, "picture letters to the children of a former governess, illustrated fictional tales about creatures in the garden." Quote, "I don't know what to write to you," read one from 1893, "so I shall tell you a story about four little rabbits whose names were Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and Peter." It was the governess, Annie Moore, who suggested that Potter turn the letters into books and sell them. Potter knew there was a market for books that were physically small, like Helen Bannerman's The Story of Little Black Sambo, and she wanted her book to be affordable. About a year after Warren and Company published Peter Rabbit, there were almost 60,000 copies in print, Lear wrote. In 1905, when she was 39, Potter got engaged to the editor with whom she collaborated, Norman Warren, although to her parents' disapproval. They believed a publisher would not be a good enough match for their daughter. But Warren died of leukemia a month later. Potter, for her part, continued to work with his family's publishing house, writing most of her books between 1900 and 1913. The world that Potter conjured in her books, whimsical but dark, full of bloodless observations about the food chain, appealed as much to adults as to children. Quote, "It would never do to eat your own customers. They would leave us and go to Tabitha Twitchert's," remarks a yellow tomcat named Ginger, who, with a dog named Pickles, owns a shop patronized by mice and rabbits, in Potter's Ginger and Pickles. "On the contrary," Pickles replies, "they would go nowhere at all." The stories are replete with consequences for rudeness, missteps, and plain old bad luck, but they were also charming and warm. When the tailor of Gloucester falls ill and is unable to finish making a waistcoat for the mayor's wedding, a team of mice sew a cherry red garment, and Jeremy Fisher, a frog, goes on a misadventure to find lunch for his friends, Sir Isaac Newton and Alderman Ptolemy Tortoise, who only eats salad. Maurice Sendak, who acquired rare copies of Potter's books, acknowledged being influenced by her work. Peter Rabbit, for all its gentle tininess, loudly proclaims that no story is worth the writing, no picture worth the making, if it is not a work of imagination, he wrote in Caldecott and Company, Notes on Books and Pictures, a book of essays. Still, Potter never sought to be a celebrity. She used the money from her book sales to buy and preserve the farmland that had inspired her tales, and as she grew older and her literary output slowed, she increasingly devoted herself to life in the country. Somehow, when one is up to the eyes in work with real, live animals, it makes one despise paper book animals. But I mustn't say that to my publisher, she wrote cheekily to one of them in 1918. She bought Hilltop Farm in England's Northwest Lake District in 1905, eventually becoming a prize-winning sheep breeder and a conservationist, and continued buying land with William Helis, a lawyer she married when she was 47. By then, quote, very few people knew that Mrs. Helis was also Beatrix Potter, said Levy Joy, a former chairwoman of the Beatrix Potter Society. Potter's stories have been adapted into films, including one of a 1971 ballet, The Tales of Beatrix Potter, and two adaptations of Peter Rabbit, a 1991 HBO movie with Carol Burnett, and a 2018 animated version. Renee Zellweger played the author in the 2006 biopic, Miss Potter. On her death, Potter left 4,000 acres of farmland to England's National Trust, a conservation charity. Her posthumous books included a diary, which was written in code, deciphered and finally published in 1966. A belatedly discovered story called The Tale of Kitty in Boots, which was published in 2016 with illustrations by Quentin Blake, and her mushroom illustrations, 59 of which appear in a 1967 natural history book written by a professional mycologist. You've been listening to All Things History, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Doug Johnson, and if you're a history buff, we would love to hear your thoughts and ideas on an interesting topic for us to investigate. Thanks for listening.
This is BirdNote. But before BirdNote existed, John Kessler was recording the sounds of Seattle for public radio station KPLU, now called KNKX, from the fairy whistle to the space needle elevator operator.
Welcome to the elevator.
To salmon leaping in a stream. But after 100 or so of these sounds, John was feeling stumped.
I was like, what makes sound? What makes sound? And I was like, oh, wait, birds. Birds make sound.
He connected with some local birders to find the best spots in the city.
I saw some amazing stuff that I had no idea was there, like the great blue heron rookery at the Ballard Locks. They took me to hear winter wrens at a park overlooking Puget Sound. They also sent me with a grebe expert at Green Lake. 100 feet from a four-lane highway, there's these beautiful birds making their little nests on top of the lily pads.
Shortly after, BirdNote's founder, Chris Peterson, sought out John's musical ear to help create a sound-rich show highlighting the joy of birds. John worked as BirdNote's senior producer for over 18 years. Recently retired from the show, birds are still a part of John's life. He uses a recording device outside his home to keep track of his local feathered friends. And he's hoping to spend a little more time focusing on his own music. For BirdNote, I'm Mark Bramhill.
Are you a fan of 1960s and 70s popular music? We invite you to tune into our new show, Music to Your Ears, hosted by Paul Buccico. Music to Your Ears will be airing on the first Sunday of each month at 6 p.m.
she's gone.
As always, thank you for listening to Audio Journal.